telescope, three colors so you can distinguish what else you're seeing, both what's the source of, what kind of CND disturbance you're looking at, but then also foregrounds and stuff, which I won't much talk about. It's a 6-meter dish, so that gives you beam sizes of between 1 and 2 arc minutes, and that corresponds to L of, okay, I mean, everyone has a favorite translator. What I did was looked at our simulations of this or that effect and looked at where the error bars got bad, and so on. So I say L of, I noticed going through the stuff getting ready for this talk that there aren't any ACT team official numbers here, but so more or less, neighborhood of the second peak out to L of 7,000. And well, here, just to give credit, it's a big team. Lyme is the PI, right? parts come from all over, and one of the things, it happened a bit with WMAP, but more here, is that there's a coherent plan at the start of other observations, which I'm going to tell you are really crucial, and a strong theory team, and a data pipeline that's more or less organized. So we have a hope of putting together a coherent study. But so here we go. Then what I'm just using ACT as an excuse at the start to talk about the high L spectrum. And so there's a bunch of stuff, as I think Lyman hinted, not yet known and that we will learn here. I make a list here, and I'm not going to, one of the things I'm not going to talk about, neutrino mass, non-Gaussianity, non-adiabatic modes, right? So I'm going to talk about how to constrain the spectral index a bit. I'm going to show you that we see the early growth of structure and measure the matter power spectrum in an interesting region, and tell you, you didn't bring this with you. tell you, but not really explain, that we have a plan to measure W as a function of redshift. And then here's this remark, that the high L spectrum is going to measure tests of field theories at 10 minus 35 seconds. ACT is not a, standardly when you see this, you say, oh, this must be a CMB polarization experiment. I mean, by now, almost automatic response. So ACT is not a polarized receiver. We'll set part of the constraints here, and it's crucial that there are polarization experiments coming along line at the same time. So here's this plot Lyman already showed, my favorite WMAP result. And I've shown the WMAP only stuff here. So I know he said all this, but just to orient myself, if not you guys, I go back over it again. What's plotted is a likelihood function for tensor to scalar ratio against spectral index. And in any model, the longer you sit in inflation, the more you're driven to n equals 1. So you see, you know, here's a model being driven, and so forth. And so wouldn't you like to have 100 times smaller error bars on this graph? That's the real starting point for I hope Lyman convinced you that we do, in fact, get error bars which are this big with WMAP, but there's no way that that experiment's going to pick up a factor of 100 here and do the kinds of precision that we want. So there's ACT, which is an intensity thing at a different angular regime, will help to resolve the spectral index. And I'll say a few words about that. And then there are a host of polarization experiments coming along. And I've listed a bunch here. So Planck has polarization-sensitive bolometers. Clover is a UK experiment. SPIDER is a balloon experiment. I'm part of Bart Netterfield, Andrew Lang, and you're talking on Wednesday about SPIDER. EBEX is a competitive balloon experiment, SPUD, BICEP. Andrew's talking about BICEP. Also Wednesday. Unlike everything on this list, BICEP has data. Is that right? And then, just as an aside, I thought I'd mention, part of what's happening here, both for ACT
And for all of these proposed polarization experiments, there is a revolution going on in how bolometers are made. And all of these things use a kind of new style of huge arrays. Once your detectors are limited by fluctuations in the number of photons they receive, making your detector more sensitive isn't all that helpful. And so all of these things take the approach of making many, many more detectors. And so making arrays of superconducting bolometers makes that possible. I know this isn't mostly experiment builders in the crowd. Bolometers that we used to make individual ones took, you know, a handful of wires into the cryostat to run one bolometer. You now run handfuls of bolometers per wire. And so you can actually put 10,000 bolometers into a single cryostat where you couldn't before. More or less as an advertisement, I put here in red experiments which use electronics which we developed for SCUBA 2, but then it turns out that they're useful all kinds of places. And in fact, although we called them the SCUBA 2 electronics initially, they first saw light from the sky on ACT. But they're used all over. Well, you've seen this plot before, too. And I just want to put a slightly more optimistic spin on it, which is it's easier to understand WMAP's beam where WMAP's beam is bright and big, and to understand ACT's beam out here at the angular regime where ACT is quite responsive, and to understand their ratio than to understand the WMAP beam alone to enough precision to make progress here. So another way to say this is if I just take this graph, which Lyman did show, of taking out the sigma 8 degeneracy so that I've normalized various models to the peak, the peak in the power spectrum at the first Doppler oscillation, and I ask how big is the variation out here at L of a few thousand, then here's the, just looking by eye, a couple percent variation in the spectral index makes a more than couple percent difference in the height. So if you have, but that's not progress, right? I mean, we already, that's just sort of comparable to current error bar levels. So to make progress here, you would like an experiment in this angular scale regime where you've measured the total beam response to way better than a percent, a bit better than a percent. So WMAP's an existence proof. You can do that with an experiment. And our goal is to do that with ACT, and it will be hard because, you know, you measure your beam profile, and then it gets into the noise. But the integral in the noise is more than 1% of your beam profile. So you really have to both have great data and have a model. Okay, so now maybe I go back just because this is the last picture I have of the whole spectrum, and just talk about a bunch of the other effects. So I say we can measure the spectral index, and that is on the assumption that these six parameters that WMAP fits are the six and that we don't add anything else in. And if you add in other stuff, there are things you can add in which then are going to, you know, are listed as interesting other things to measure, but they're going to make it so that you'll get confused as to whether or not we really measured a spectral index. One of the things is it's a sort of tempting remark to say that there's a, just as the location of the first peak is a measurement of a thing whose physical size you should know. It's the plasma speed times the age of the universe that uncoupling gives you a physical size. And so measuring this is a clean parameter. There's another physical scale we should know, which is the thickness of the layer of last coupling. And that gives a slope out here. But if we take that as a new free parameter, then I don't get to measure that and NS. So you have to sort of choose in language here. And then there are a bunch of other effects, and I guess I list them here, that take place at small angular scales and have a quite different shape or a different spectrum from that thing. So a different frequency spectrum. And ACT is designed to measure a bunch of these things. We're either going to tell them by their spectral signature, for example, foreground point sources of the Sonnier-Zeldovich effect, or by their shape and power spectrum space for these middle guys. And so I'm guessing I
don't need to say what the Sonnier-Zeldovich effect is,
but as photons go through hot clusters, well, I say it in the next slide, so anyway, we get to it. By measuring the Sonnier-Zeldovich effect, we can study the effect of cluster formation. We'd like to measure gravitational lensing of the microwave background. Alone, it has a clear signature. There's a five-point function, and so if you see it in a map, you should be able just to recognize it on its own. I think there's fairly little physics in that. I mean, there is mass between us and the surface of last scattering, and so there will be lensing. But if you measure the matter between us and that surface, then you might be able to undo a kind of tomography and measure accelerations as a function of redshift. And so then there's physics in that. There's scattering of the microwave background off of free electrons at the epoch of reionization or elsewhere that there would be free electrons. And these have a bunch of different names depending on if you're in the linear regime or not. But either of them measure structure, not average values, but the structure in the free electron density. So you measure a mass power spectrum in the region between us and the surface of last scattering. And then, as I said, as an unavoidable nuisance, but then also because they're interesting, we see foreground point sources. So I'm going to pick a couple of these. Start with the Sonnier-Zeldovich effect. Photons come through some place where there are hot electrons. On average, they pick up energy. But the number of photons doesn't change, so you don't have a blackbody curve. So it's the easiest way for me to say that. So unavoidably, you have fewer low-energy photons and extra high-energy photons. And that's a nice thing, because it's kind of CMB-ish. But there's structure here right at the place where you would put your detectors anyway if you're looking at the CMB. And it has a dip and a peak and a null. So it's an easy thing to recognize. And so it's plotted there. And so we've chosen the ACT wave bands. I guess this isn't so strikingly clear, but that's not a projection artifact. There's a channel there in which there's not much Sonnier-Zeldovich signal present. So we have a band which is at the null and should be able then to unscramble those three.
Frequencies where you do not see graphic.
What? So
we have
ACT is built with three cameras, one of which is chosen to be near to this. Because this is essentially a derivative of the blackbody function, you know the frequency that it, independent of what cluster it is that's doing scattering, you know this frequency. So it's 2/17. And we could have a real null here if we had detectors which were so sensitive that they could have a Hertz bandwidth or whatever, right? So we have an actual width and you have an actual signal, but it's quite small. The other thing that's striking is that this is positive and that's negative. So a blip or a source or a thing in the time series or something isn't going to look like that. So this is, I wish all interesting astrophysical things were this clean and easy to find. I say casually, not that people are coming.
This is so important because it proves there is a CMB, which is getting shadowed.
Oh, yes. Right, right. So for the complete skeptic, if you see a cold spot and hot spots at these two frequencies, and you think you know the object which caused them, then you know that there's a CMB as seen by that object. And in the, if the intensities are right, then the CMB is more or less uniform on the sky as seen by that object. So, right, that's, I don't know what's the current record for the highest SZ detection. It's redshift of a couple.
It's obviously because people like you without faith don't see enough of any extent.
Right. I think that goes beyond believing in data to say that no one has seen the S. Is that the...
There's many reliable detections
of S. There's 50
sigma
detections of
S. Yeah.
No question.
So
after redshift right. 1, probably.
There are not 50 beyond redshift 1, but there are a handful of sources that are about redshift 1 or 1 plus a little bit, where several different groups.
This is a serious reality check. I mean,
Yeah, but I would claim that at the level of, you know, is the CMB arranged in our solar system or something, that check has been done. And it gets harder and harder to arrange to make a CMB if you have to make it at redshift 1 instead of 1,000.
How many of the detections are both sides of the
knot?
Have they been any on both sides of the knot?
Well, there have been many, but a robust handful or more on both sides of the knot. I mean, not that it's the best job of it,
but I mean, not at all. But Mike Zemkov and I went through the SCUBA archive. People for years have been trying to find the SZ and didn't know how to analyze the data, in our view. And if you just don't subtract the average of your array before you start, which wipes out the signal, then you see a signal. And so we have, you know, 10 sources where we've seen them at 850 microns, which is 350 gigahertz. And there's good OVRO or other measurements of the two different instruments.
I think it's hard to make an instrument that works at 3 millimeters and 1/4 millimeter. On one dish, just to clear. So I guess let me say one other thing as long as we're doing a sort of tutorial bit here. We're seeing these things as shadows or as disturbances or something like that. They don't fall off in brightness when they're far away. So you can see clusters out as far as they are. This is way nicer than finding clusters by looking at their X-ray signature or something where far things that are far away are dim. So this is a great way to find collapsed hot baryons at any distance, wherever they are. They produce a signal which is more or less uniform. And in fact, the angular size, the way it is, you know, goes through a kind of a minimum at a redshift of a cube and then gets slightly bigger. But these things are about an arc minute or so over a big range of redshifts. So this is a way. You don't, if you just see something in the SZ, you don't know how far away it is. But this is a way of finding clusters out to enormous redshift if they're there. So just to, I guess, expand on that remark that things are about an arc minute, typically when they, you know, almost no matter where they are. Here's a simulation of a patch of sky done at high resolution, which is just the Sinyag-Zaldovich effect, and filtered by 1.7 arc minute beam, which is a beam at which we size at which we can analyze our three channels, and with twice the MBAC noise. So MBAC is the sort of full operational
camera for ACT, and it's not been on the telescope yet. And then For comparison, Planck has a bigger angular size. So this is signal seen by ACT and seen by Planck. So I mean, you know, depending on what you think of the noise and so forth, there is a signal here, but there's a substantially more precision available. So here's the Planck error bars, and this is the signal we're looking for. and here's the act uncertainty. So this experiment is designed to do that. And again, what's the requirement? Stable operation, great knowledge of your beam, three good maps at three colors. So now there are also other effects that unfortunately have the same spectrum as the CMB. And so anything that comes from, the Sunyaev-Zoldovich effect is Thompson scattering too, but it was a pretty specially arranged geometry. So if you have structure, Thompson scattering produces a parent temperature difference if there's a coherent velocity or if there's a gradient in the number density of electrons. And that can arise any number of different ways. So here's the basic expression. And the terms are defined here, I guess, except chi, which is a proxy for integrating along the line of sight. And gamma is a unit vector along the line of sight. And so what you're measuring is if there's structure in the radial velocities or if there's structure in the density, then you'll see structure in the temperature anisotropy. So measuring anisotropy at angular scales where there's structure in either of those terms constrains that product. I maybe just go through the words here a bit. Maybe the next slide's the place to go through the words. I'll start back here. I'm sorry, I'm so confused. Traditionally, people have considered structure in the density and structure in the velocity field quite separately. And so the thing which is called the Ostreicher-Wisniak effect is when structures are early in the growing phase and there's no correlations between velocities and densities yet in a statistical way, then if you see a density gradient in a place where there's a coherent velocity bigger than the size of the density gradient, you'll see a signal. So that kind of density gradient, if it's a smooth thing, is called the Ostreicher-Wisniak effect. And if it comes because of the fact that half the electrons see half the sky as neutral and half of it is reionized, that's called patchy reionization. But it's this same, you're going to do this same integral of the line of sight. So here, that I hope now explains what's going on in this graph. If you just ignore the different words, the Wisniak effect is labeled as the thing where the system is still linear and velocities and densities are not correlated particularly. Once coherent structures form and you're out of the linear regime, they are correlated. And that takes the name of the kinetic. There was a remark about you're supposed to use chalk, which I want to do later, but there isn't chalk, right? Hidden chalk. Oh, look, oh, there's tons of chalk. Color, anybody? If I imagine that I have a cluster, so there's stuff falling into it, and I'm looking along some line of sight, where should I be? I get both signs of the velocity. So a cluster sitting still doesn't give a contribution to that term. But if the cluster was moving, then either it's moving this way and that arrow disappears, or it's moving that way and this arrow disappears. And so the integral along the line of sight doesn't vanish anymore, doesn't cancel. So it's not that what we're talking about is coherent clusters that you can name and find and pick out with tweezers and they have velocities, but I'm just explaining the name for it. This is called the kinetic Sunyaev-Zoldovich effect because it does happen if you take a cluster and move it. But the basic thing is you're measuring one other moment of the structure, which is the velocity, the dot product of the velocity gradients and density gradients. And so here again, just the point is that we looked at the physics and then designed ACT. ACT is sensitive here. So we measure the spectrum in a regime where at the lowest Ls, it's dominated by the stuff generated in the linear regime. And at the highest Ls is a substantial term from nonlinear physics. And we will recognize that not from its frequency spectrum, because it's got the same frequency spectrum as the microwave background, but from its shape on this graph. So if we, what we're looking for now is a departure. You know, it's a new term in the anisotropy, which causes the spectrum not to keep doing these ripples and continuing down this silk damping path. So, okay, the picture is already now complicated enough. If I've said we're going to measure the spectral index, and we can measure the thickness of the layer at recombination, and we're going to look for, so there's going to be some editing of how to find all these things at once, and we need to be a little careful. But so let me walk through some simulations here just to give a sense. So I have the same picture now for each of our channels. One thing to notice is if you look at this one, which is the combination of them, I just walk through them. I'm not convinced that people will think this is changing enormously and that it's obvious that you're going to pick out four different signals and take their Fourier transform. But the signal is there. They all have quite different and well predicted. This has a L cubed spectrum, but plus you might actually recognize them as point sources. This has the spectrum I showed. That has a particular color to it. It is a recognizable set, and one can unscramble it. 220, that's the null here in the Sinyaev-Zoldovich. There it appears in the opposite sign again. There are meant to be more things here, so let me imagine that if I press this. Sorry. It's a slide I borrowed, and I'm not really into hiding the parts and showing you one at a time. Here we go. The top is just what the signal is. This is the same content, but I'm just trying to make it plausible to you that we are really going to extract signals. The top is the CMB and SZ. Here's those three pictures, which to the I know that if I rearrange the order of those, that almost no one in the audience would object, right? And here's the extracted signal at the bottom. Yes. So this is Huffenberger and Zeljak, and so it's in print for what that's worth. But sorry, that's an evasive answer. For the details of the calculation, I'm not going to. Okay.
But things from P-track, the simulation that came into that book.
So P-track is the Fourier spectrum. We're putting in a guess, and this is our record.
So this would be a good time to remind everybody that everything I've said, there's someone in the room knows more about than I do. Well, I want to show some hardware and talk about detectors, so I might make this. The CMB should be lens. Again, here, this is, the top is the CMB and the bottom is the CMB lens. And if I had, in my haste, prepared this, swapped those, no one in the audience would have raised their hand and said, hang on a minute, isn't this the bare CMB? Mm-hmm. But there is a unique five-point function. It is a recognizable thing. And so here's the lensing signal, not insanely bright. Can I say anything more about that? Oh, well, here. I guess while I'm listening, this is just a list of the team that's going out and trying to get lots of other data on our field. But let me just say in words that if you have good optical data from which you can make a weak lensing model, and you have the CMD lensing signal, that the comparison of those lets you do tomography. So there's, to me, real hope that at some level you'll measure this W as a function of redshift. I'm not prepared to defend exactly how many signals that is, but I mean, it's a serious goal. And it would be, I think of it the same way as I think of this NOLTA goal, where we use the radio sources to measure acceleration at redshift of 1. It has to be there, but once you see it, it puts to rest all kinds of other models you're looking for. And I think measuring W that way will be reassuring, even if the result is not controversial. So now I'm just going to say a few things about how the experiment works. The goal here is very clean experiment, understand our beam, low side lobes, a very careful control of systematic error. And so one way we do that is by having a quite nice scanning strategy. I think, you know, this feels like the WMAP design process over again. You go through what the physics is you want to do, and then you just think what the scanning strategy has to be. And then you make whatever you have to make to make that scanning strategy. So because we're on Earth, we're going to scan in azimuth and not in elevation to not pick up either a change in the ground radiation or a change in the atmosphere. So I think, there's meant to be some way to show this as a movie. There we go. So as we scan and the Earth turns, we scan these red patches. And then after the Earth has turned far enough, we can turn our instrument once in azimuth to look somewhere else. But of course, I mean, I stopped the movie, but the Earth doesn't stop turning. So then we scan like that. So we're going to map this ring with cross-linked patterns from which you can invert the time series and make a nice map of the sky, while only ever looking at one elevation angle and only ever scanning back and forth in a simple way. So I say it's a simple way, but it's a 6-meter telescope, and it's moving 2 degrees a second. So it's about like this, moving through a few degrees. They're 5-ish. 2 degrees a second, but the... Do you remember the azimuthal number? But it's like 5. Yeah. No, don't read it off the... Things not to read off the graph is the size, and no, we don't look at the sky through the dirt. So the observations always happen exactly there or exactly here. So 2 degrees a second allows us to come back to the left-hand edge every few seconds. So we just need a 1 over f ni of tenths of a hertz, well, less than that. But that regime in order to have a multiply crossed up image. So. Okay, but look, if we're shaking this thing back and forth, you'd like not to be taking your receiver and shaking it, because that's a way to get... So the whole system has to be a rigid system. Here's the can with all of our detectors in it, secondary, primary, points at the sky. That whole thing moves as a rigid structure with the axis running through our cryostat. Here it is. Here we are in Canada. I live in Canada. Although this is a U.S.-funded experiment, it was built in Vancouver in Coquitlam by AMAC, who made, Exploring California? There's some little sky ride with and the GM racetrack at Disney World, and
the Keck Dome and the Subaru Dome. So they do a variety of things. They made the Blast Gondola, and they made this. And I think they made money on the Disney rides. but I'm having a hard time picturing. So here's this thing. I don't know what's a physical scale here, but a person is about, you know, like that. So this weighs 35 tons, that weighs 70 tons. Here's the elevation axis. And this, everything you see here above this level turns back and forth like that. So it's, we have a class in how to build telescopes, and we took them out to see that. And when the motor comes on, they all, even though they're far away, everybody backs up because you're not used to seeing buildings move. Okay, so here, as again I said, this is just trying to give you a picture. We've got this off-axis design, and then we hide it in an enormous ground shield with a curved top. And I kept this diagram as much as anything else because I have a photograph of this. So this is, we've got guard rings on here, and then the mirrors go on in panels, the primary mirror. So in this drawing, the mirror is not there. And in this photo, it's not there. Have you seen this picture before? So this is me up at the top of that structure looking down like that, and there was Lyman. So I happened to have my camera. And you notice, actually, anybody up at the top who ever drops anything, it goes skittering down like this, misses Lyman, and lands here as trash down at the bottom. So there are scutters at the to get rid of snow that might accumulate. And so there are the panels put in place. And I guess, you know, the people in the expensive seats here, which are empty, can see that these are smooth, and those are just ratty pieces of aluminum with, so that we've extended the mirror beyond the good panels. But so here's the stack of panels. Each has four actuators on the back. You have a walkie-talkie. You say, no, no, more, and crank the panels in and out, measure them carefully. And so here's the surface RMS plotted against the day on which it was measured. And so we've got a 30-something micron RMS surface. And I should just point out the date. So this is today. So this is an experiment which is being built, you know, now. Right? So this is the surface work in Chile that's happened this week. And so there it is, showing the ground shield. But the part of this I guess I want to talk about, I have 5 minutes or something, is that right? 10? Oh, wow. I should slow down. I'd like to talk a bit about the detectors that go into it, partially because that's a part that I'm involved in, but partially also because there's going to be a bunch of experiments that you're going to hear about that involve this new generation of heavily multiplexed detectors. And I know, in the kind of Kobe-Firas era, there was this fad of trying to explain what temps and bolometers were to theorists. And so I guess, although that wasn't very successful, I'll try again. And this is a photograph of an ACT array. But I mean, other arrays are mildly different. But you see there's a bunch of bolometers, no feed horns. You just focus the skylight on them. And there's some way of reading them out and some way of absorbing light generically. So they are bolometers. The particular flavor for ACT is a thing invented by Harvey Moseley, where you take an array and make a 1D strip of bolometers and then amazingly fold the silicon like this so that all the wiring is hidden from you. It's insane, and the first, you know, 100 tries to fold the thing ended up with two pieces of silicon and detectors dangling off of the two parts. But it does work, and so Shark has been running for years in that geometry. Here's a closer view of pixels, and you see this thinly etched folded silicon, and then I don't know if you can see a sort of gray shadow running down that one. There are alternatives. In Andrew's lab, they're making antenna coupled arrays, which are planar to start with, and that's more fab work, but you can do it. SCUBA 2 is an array like that, which is bump bonded, and the wires go out the bottom. So this is, the folding isn't the important part. The really important part is these are superconducting transitions. You can read them out in a grid. You don't need a wire per thing, so they're multiplexed. And so here, Kent Irwin's gang at NIST have made a multiplexer which sits there, and then a series array, squid series array amplifier. What this is just 200 more squids run in series. So you look at tiny current differences caused by a heat change and read them out. I wonder. So, yeah, I can. But let me do that here, if you can see it, I guess. What you want to do is read out a lot of bolometers for very few wires. So if you make a system which looks like this, there's a TES and a shunt, and so I'm going to apply a voltage to a string which has a number of shunts in it. Shunt, shunt, shunt. And off of each of these, I put my detector and a coil, another detector and a coil. So these are independent of each other. If there's a current flowing through here and this resistance is small, these are all effectively voltage biased and independently. So for one bias line, I can bias up the whole array by running this thing around. And then I just need to find a way to read these one at a time. So this coil dumps flux into a squid, and the squid is a great current measuring device. So I measure the current in each of these. I leave these on all the time because they're thermal devices and they need to stay on. And I leave them biased. But I can turn the squids on and off at megahertz. So the new thing here is that I have one bias line and I can have one squid readout line. So for two wires, I can read out 1,000 pixels by just popping which one I turn off and on at which time. So here, no one can see these faint lines, which they need to see, right? Let me say how, if I plot resistance as a function of temperature, I just want to say why is it that a bit of superconductor that's voltage biased acts like a radiation detector? So I've got some device there which has a resistance curve which looks like this, right? And so if I were to plot voltage across it and current through it, if it just looked like this, voltage, current, I would get a line. So what's happening is, if I voltage bias it, well, in here where the resistance is zero, to get to a given voltage at 0 ohms requires an infinite current. So it doesn't do that, and it goes out here to where it's normal. So if I am sitting somewhere here where I and V are large enough that I'm applying enough heat here that I've moved this over to this place, then that's fine. And so at high values of I and V, it acts like a normal thing. And then when I come down into here, what happens is if I voltage bias it, it will sit at this transition. It'll just take more and more current to do that. So it enters a regime in which I, V equals a constant until my electronics can't do that anymore. And then that turns over. So generically, I get a thing like that, where this line, IV, is a constant. The constant is the amount of power needed to take your bolometer from the bath up to the transition temperature, given the thermal conductivity and so forth. So if I shine light on this, then I need to provide less IV power. So this is, that I'm going to call dark. And this is illuminated. So that's the basic idea, is that you voltage bias these things, you sit at some voltage, and as you shine light on it, the amount of current changes, and you read it out with squids. As a demonstration, Carl Rinsema at NIST put 100 switching between channels using frequency instead of timing it, put 100 elements on two wires, and just he's got these two wires going into a cryostat. 100. I mean, it's handy. The other thing which is nice here is the impedance of these devices is now tenths of an ohm, so they're no longer microphones. The bolometers, which you know I made as a kid and Andrew made and so forth, have millions of ohms impedance. You shake them in an electric field, you get a big voltage. So you can take these things and knock on it, and you don't see them. You can run these with pulse tube coolers, which, yes, no, that's right. I traded one thing for another. But when I am in my lab and hopping around, and as long as I don't move the chairs, I don't make a big magnetic disturbance. So you can talk while you're working on these and so on, which is convenient. You're right. There are many experimental cryostats whose weight is completely dominated by magnetic shielding. So, okay. As I move the thing in a As I move the thing, I'm going to generate little currents. And across a, maybe going to get this backwards.
Yeah. I'm not. You think it's a completely capacitive thing? Okay.
Capacitance changes are sort of constant, but they're more important if there's a large resistance, something like that.
Moving something around is a current.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then I have a huge resistor.
Right.
And then I get a huge voltage. But the only thing that's bothering me is here I am measuring current. Whereas
we're fairly far from cosmology.
Yeah, we are. So why don't I we can have okay. And here one other thing which is going on is the readout is now sort of computer intensive right at the start. And so when we deliver electronics, we deliver electronics and a computer, and we know the root password. The Princeton guys have done a pretty good job of confounding us on that last point. But if these things are going to work in Atacama or in a balloon payload or something, they have to be remotely usable, and this is kind of nice. So here is a feedback signal and an error in these servos of block-longers. Measured in my lab for a cryostat that was in Princeton, because you know we're in different time zones, so they amazingly got hired and went home and said we could have it, and we can, and so you can run these things at huge distances. Is that for me?
Yeah.
So here again, just to show rapid progress, this is 23rd of August. The 145 gigahertz camera. Assembled. The light plays off of it, so it's not as nice a picture as that array of kilometers I showed at the start. And within a, what's the next slide? Well, yeah, so not this, right? But within a few days, that was in the cryostat, and about 90% of the pixels locked up and running. And again, so that's 2 weeks ago that was on the bench, a week ago that it was cold and locked up, and it's warm and ready. Isn't it
work?
It's
still cold.
Okay.
And we have a prototype camera, 8 by 32 instead of 32 by 32 bolometers. So sitting at Jupiter, this is just a drift scan to show that we do have a telescope and we do have detectors and you can look at the sky. It's Jupiter. It's honking bright. So you shouldn't think that this is the best map we'll ever get. I should just point out, this was taken before the surface alignment, and we only really thought about it afterwards. It was taken before the ladder that you saw in that drawing was removed from in front of the primary. So somewhere in here, you see the image of Jupiter convolved with the Fourier transform of a ladder. I have slides on scuba too, but I think I just stop here. I'm over time. Just for kicks, it's not quite. It's a change in topic, but a lot of this technology was invented with a big kick of Canadian funding for Scuba 2, which is a new camera for the JCMT. Scuba 1, it's not allowed to be called Scuba 1, but Scuba in 2003 or 4 was the most highly cited ground-based instrument because at a part of a millimeter and on a big dish, it's perfectly situated for understanding most of the star formation history, a lot of the star formation history of the universe. So I have a graph here of just background radiation in the sky. And the CMB we know about is what we've been talking about here. But the next bright thing is the far infrared background. And that is starlight absorbed by dust, re-emitted at temperatures of 20 to 40 Kelvin. And it's a huge fraction of the total light. So a big part of this detector development is really cosmology, and it is for studying the star formation history of the universe. I just show Scuba 2 is a camera. It's being delivered to the JCMT. A big chunk of time, it's an increase in a factor of 1,000 of the mapping speed of that telescope. So obviously, you don't want to take some little itty-bitty thing where you just need 3 pixels anyway and use it. So a big fraction of the time has been given to surveys. And I just want to point out two of them here, the cosmology survey at 450 microns and a cosmology survey at 850 microns. This is looking for these dusty galaxies. And that's about half the total time awarded. And I should say, well, here, just to give names for. So I'm a coordinator for those two surveys. This all-sky survey, Douglas Scott, who's sitting here, is the coordinator on. And in the kind of a coup, I think, for Canada, the main UK PI of getting Scuba 2 built, the scientific leader of that, Jim Dunlop, just accepted a Tier 1 chair at UBC. So this will be a part of Canadian cosmology shortly. I mean, there's a big active community here already, but growing in strength. So just a sort of teaser for what you might try and find out is if you find thousands of point sources on the sky, you're not really going to spend that much time fussing about what each one is. But you might measure their correlation function. And so the black curves there are just made up numbers as though they were correlated the same as these other things. But the idea is if you measure the correlation function of these things, you can tell what size mass structures they're in or whether or not they're moving across mass boundaries in halos. I stop there.
Do I understand correctly that you will be able in a year to do perhaps even better than Planck, some part of the Planck work?
Temperature.
No, just question. From our side.
So ACT and Planck are going to do different things here.
Yeah,
so
yeah, they say ACT, but this is the part of the Planck test. Yes. So as you understand, so, but I mean measuring temperature correlation function to very, very high multiples. So
yes.
And also you will be able to separate contribution of Sinais and Dovich and
right.
CMB, etc. So it's, I think, it was
right.
It's
yeah.
Not the only one. I mean. It's
but South Pole, I mean, it was in the initial series. South Pole Telescope also has similar kilometers, similar number of kilometers, similar size dish. So
for instance, spectral index, we will know perhaps there's a little more than 3 sigma in a year or so.
Well,
hopefully by
the next
study,
at least 1 and 3 sigma.
Right, but like, next WMAP release will be before the first scientific publication
yeah,
of this
yeah,
experiment.
Yeah,
okay, good.
Paper term. There's drafts and so forth. But, yeah, but let me put back in. So these are experiments which basically haven't happened yet. I mean, South Pole Telescope has data, ACT has that goofy map of Jupiter, right? We're very far from that beautiful map of mirror temperature against time, or gain as a function of whatever, or a model that Leibniz wrote for WMAP. So it should work.
Okay.
So I'll just advertise there's the new release from ACBAR that will come out in the next 2 months with significantly more precise points. And that'll be interesting.
Okay.
So, as a question, if not, then we may break half an hour. And we are here in 11:05.